My name is Chris Deasy. Welcome to the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. We have a real treat this week because my guest is filmmaker, screenwriter, and theologian Craig Detweiler. Now, Craig lives in Los Angeles. He grew up in North Carolina. We learn about his journey to film school in California. He discusses Black Lives Matter, the Equal Justice Initiative. We talk about the film Just Mercy, the role of nostalgia in charting our lives from childhood, how people who work in the film industry in Hollywood don't take their successes for granted. We discuss how some of the best films have been made about people who live on the wrong side of Hollywood. We think, for example, of Paul Thomas Anderson's Magnolia. We talk about the artifice and the green screen dimension to films and compare it to the big Hollywood sets of yesterday's generation. For example, the recreation of sets in ancient Egypt for the film Cleopatra. We find out that Craig grew up with an attachment to cars and racing. We learn why the comedies of Norman Lear were informative and preconditioned him to seeing all people as equal. We discover that Craig kept rigorous records of Casey Kasem's Top 40 and how the eclecticism that is America was presented to the various genres of music. Craig talks about his time in the UK, in Cambridge, and how the music scene there influenced him. He brought the sounds of the UK back to Davidson College in North Carolina, and that's where he first encountered REM, who tried out their sounds in the college pub. And we learned that Craig was into rap when he was young. He has all the original records. We talk about how the time that we were ostensibly wasting as youngsters were actually investments. We learn that Craig doesn't mind trafficking in nostalgia, provided that he isn't trapped in it. We discuss how we tend to grow with the artists that we watch. We talk, for example, about the evolution from Mean Streets to Scorsese's The Irishman. At the end of the interview, Craig talks about why it is the challenges in life that are the most formative. What happens when one papers over the past in the light of what has happened, for example, with issues around civil rights and George Floyd. We talk about what Craig considers to be nostalgia's long-term bite and why Americans are always looking forward, people. So join me, Chris Deasy, for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. My guest this week from Los Angeles via Zoom is Craig Detweiler. It's fantastic to have Craig Detweiler all the way from, is it Los Angeles itself? I know you're in California, Craig.
I am in the city of the angels.
And it is so perfect because, of course, you do a lot of work in screenwriting and of course, I know you through religion and film. So you're in the most perfect place. People like me, although I love being in Canterbury and before that in Wales, I can't deny there's a part of me that thinks, you know, I'm in the wrong continent for the sort of interest that I have. You're in the right one.
I was on the wrong coast. I grew up in North Carolina and came out to graduate school in Los Angeles, both at Fuller Seminary in Pasadena and at USC, University of Southern California, at their film school, and discovered that all of my passions that were alone or singular on the East Coast were shared by thousands of people here in Southern California. And so it's always been fun to basically be able to turn my hobby, I guess, into, you know, research, a passion, and then a career.
Yeah. And so was this your dream, would you say? Was this what you always sort of set out to do? Or was it through happenstance that you ended up in the movie business, really?
It was a dream that I just thought was impossible. I didn't know one person in North Carolina who was involved with the film industry or entertainment really in any way. Yeah. And it was only after coming to seminary and meeting people in the community who, you know, were working on sitcoms or working on films. And it seemed like they almost hated what they did or didn't like the industry. And I was coming in kind of a very naive way. And we had a television producer named Coleman Luck come to our class at Fuller Seminary and really almost give a bit of an altar call. Like, if you really want to get messy, then join me in the film business, you know, come join me in Hollywood. And I think there were like 60 people in the class. I was the only one who raised my hand and essentially said, yeah, I want to come. And through his encouragement and the encouragement of other folks, I ended up applying to film school really kind of on a whim. I mean, I didn't have any film in my background other than just a love of Humphrey Bogart or, kind of classic Hollywood cinema. But when I got in film school, I was like, all right, let's go down this road and see where it leads.
And of course, we were in touch just a few months ago after Just Mercy, because I saw that it was an advanced screening just a few days before it was properly released. And I came away thinking, you know, this was really good stuff. I mean, it got some tepid reviews. I thought it was a real masterpiece, and it got me thinking. And I think the whole sort of Alabama law system in the late 80s, early 90s, and I think the debates that it then generated about what has changed in the last 30 years. And then you said that you taught, am I right in saying, the director screenwriter?
Yeah. Destin was my student at the Los Angeles Film Studies Center. It was a kind of a semester in Hollywood program for kids who were from small Christian colleges that maybe didn't have, a full-fledged film program. And so he came and got this internship in Hollywood and was in my class. And, you know, sweet, sweet guy, very talented, deeply empathetic. But, you know, I had no idea that he would, marshal his personal stories and experiences into a beautiful short film like Short Term 12, which won the Sundance Film Festival for Best Short Film, and then propelled him towards a Nichols Fellowship with the Academy, and he turned his short into his debut feature, Short Term 12, which is also just exquisitely funny and beautiful and raw, and launched all the careers of people like Brie Larson and Rami Malek and Lakeith Stanfield. So he just had an eye for young talent. He understands how to work with actors. And so when I saw that he had done Just Mercy, I was so, so proud. It was really the first feature in Hollywood that was done with an inclusion writer. So Destin, as a Hawaiian by background, teaming up with Michael B. Jordan and Jimmy Fox, they were like, hey, this production, we should make sure that we're including all kinds of voices here at the table, both on screen and then, of course, behind the screen. So, yeah, he's a real pace setter and trend setter in Hollywood. He's actually working on a film now for Marvel called Shang-Chi that'll be hopefully a bit of equivalent to Black Panther, you know, where Marvel's moving in kind of a broader, more diverse direction in their storytelling with more diverse filmmakers Destin.
Yeah, I saw an interview with Sean Penn just the other day in the UK, who was talking about how lockdown might have the effect of making the film industry just think a little bit about the kind of products it does. And I think he was feeling that there's a lot of superhero movies out there. Is that necessarily appealing to the whole demographic? But it's always very nice when you have some twists on that, because I'm not always the demographic, I don't think, for those kind of films. I go and see them anyway, but I'm sitting in the audience thinking, maybe 20 years ago I would have been right up there. Now I kind of feel I'm somebody who grew up perhaps with the Michael Keaton Batman and really liked that, but kind of somehow along the way I've just become a bit too old for some of that, really. But that sounds really good when someone like Destin, who created a piece of work as provocative as Just Mercy, might move into territory that might actually square that circle.
Well, and he has said clearly that he hoped to create a superheroes that and allow his son to feel a stronger sense of identity, to see people who look like him, you know, putting on the tights and engaging in heroic activities. And I think that's also part of it, right? That everybody feels a stronger sense of representation via the media, that we have different kinds of heroes, different kinds of backgrounds in both the storytellers and in the subjects of our film.
And have you had any contact with him since the film came out? Are you in touch with him in any way?
Yeah, we just corresponded a little bit last week, because in light of Black Lives Matter and the overall kind of uprising, or if you will, reckoning that I think is going on in the United States vis-a-vis race relations and injustice, Warner Brothers had made the film Just Mercy broadly available. And so for that reason, he was able to sort of see a whole new group of people see the film and watch it and love it. And then I think there's been a surge in donations towards the Equal Justice Initiative that Bryan Stevenson started as well as interest in the National Lynching Museum. And so so Destin and I had just a little exchange on social media, you know, where he was just saying, hey, Teach, you know, thanks for giving me, you know, kind of a way forward and giving me that encouragement. And I think in a sense, he's probably in some ways as surprised as I am that he's had this really remarkable career. I mean, you know, we knew he had talent, but it still takes so much different kinds of luck, timing, and breaks, you know, that don't always go for everybody. And so it's been wonderful to see him parlay his opportunities into bigger and better roles.
Well, absolutely, because I'm thinking that there must be so many people who are desperate to write something or direct something or to act in something and make a mark, and who never quite get that opportunity or who never really make it big. And it must be so gratifying for someone like you who cultivated, who nurtured that talent. But also, I suppose, it works for all of us. Whatever, sometimes we end up doing things that we may love, but it's never quite what we expected to be doing when we were younger. And sometimes it's a case of joining the dots. And I don't know if you're like me. I mean, maybe you are living the dream, but, you know, sometimes I'm in my mid to late 40s and I'm sometimes thinking, it's not quite what I thought I would end up doing. And of course, we didn't have podcasts back when I was younger, but something in radio, something in broadcasting was always that dream. And it's funny how we all end up sometimes finding new and creative outlets so that we're kind of doing something that's in keeping with what we set out to do all those decades earlier. Sometimes we succeed, very often we don't.
Well, and I think that's maybe the role of nostalgia is kind of tapping into what was that childhood dream? What would you do at age 10 or 12, you know, with your time? You know, I was like watching movies and taking notes and trying to figure out, you know, how many films have I seen starring, you know, Steve McQueen, you know, which else do I need? You know, I was kind of creating my own little personal IMDb. But yeah, so far removed, right, from Hollywood or the industry, it just seemed so far away. So it is kind of amazing when you can turn that childhood passion into something where you could actually be paid, you know, to write a screenplay or make a documentary. There is a certain satisfaction. And I think everybody in Hollywood, I don't think anybody takes it for granted. I think we understand, you know, it's like playing in the NBA or something. You know, it's like there's only so many 7-footers in the world, you know, who can compete at that level in the NBA. And so there's so many people trying to get into the business. I don't think anybody who's in it necessarily takes it for granted. I think we understand what a privilege it is to be able to tell stories for a living and dress up in Superman tights and you know, and have millions of people look up at you on the big screen. It is a childhood fantasy fulfilled to some people. Yeah.
But I always think of that opening scene in Tootsie when you've got Dustin Hoffman, who is obviously struggling. His character, Michael Dorsey, is struggling to make that living on the boards. But, you know, he's clearly somebody who, perhaps like Dustin Hoffman in real life, I don't know, is, you know, somebody who doesn't always gel with everybody he's trying to work with. And yet, of course, he's also waiting on tables. He's working in a restaurant. He's somebody who has to make ends meet. And, of course, we see the glamour sometimes. We see the films and the filmmakers who have made it, but we forget along the way the number of people who may have talent but maybe you're in the wrong place at the wrong time and haven't quite made it there. And I think that's a film that grows on me each time I see it, because it's very funny. It works as a comedy, but it also does a good job of showing how the film industry itself works and how sometimes one has to question or challenge or sometimes make compromises in terms of what one feels able to do in order to get ahead and the price that one pays as a result. I guess you know all about those kind of things.
Well, it's definitely an everyday struggle. I mean, particularly the actor's life, where you're auditioning and waiting and hoping, and you come in, and it really often is not about talent. It's sort of, it becomes about odd things like kind of the look of the person that they're going for, and maybe that look is based upon another person they've already cast. And so it's like, oh, you're a little too tall, or you're a little too short, or you're blonde, and we need a brunette, and you know, all of those frustrations where they're literally judging, right, your appearance rather than, you know, your actual talent. And so that struggle of in a sense being a book that is judged by its cover, I think, can be very disheartening. to actors. And I think some of the best movies have been made about that struggle. You know, Paul Thomas Anderson makes films about people in the San Fernando Valley who are not quite on the right side of Hollywood. You know, they're kind of on the wrong side of the hill. And in a film like Magnolia, you know, it's sort of like, what about that struggle of the everyday person in Hollywood surrounded by the glamour? And yet what's going on behind the scenes in everyday life?
Yeah, no, I think that's a really good example, because there's the sort of the glamour, but the seediness underneath the glamour. And also the people, of course, in Boogie Nights as well, with the whole transition from film to video and the way in which people think, oh, you know, we can't get a big studio to make our film, so therefore we'll release it on video. And of course, we look back now. I watched the film a couple of years ago and I thought, video, you know, who could have made a good product on video when, of course, you know, it doesn't have the same durability. You can't put something into, you know, on Blu-ray or stream it so well when it's in that format. But, you know, we are where we are. But yeah, I think Robert Altman, of course, does similar things with various, you know, looks at the other side of the movie industry from a Californian perspective, but also has made a real career out of doing that. So, you know, it sort of works. The independent filmmakers and the big shots as well are both probably very aware of their origins and the importance of paying homage to that.
Well, some of the greatest films in Hollywood history, whether it's Sunset Boulevard or Sweet Smell of Success or even Mulholland Drive, you know, they're all looking at like kind of the dark underbelly of the industry. But of course, that's true for any industry, right? I mean, if you make a political film at this point, not much to admire out there, right? A lot more to lament in how that city or industry might work. So I think there's drama to be had wherever, and there's people who struggle wherever. But Hollywood as a dream factory, I think the gap between maybe those nostalgic visions and imagination that you may have as a kid and then the reality, even if you think about the superhero films now where you see the finished result on screen, you don't realize they're standing around in front of a green screen. You know, they're like wearing tights in front of a green screen, you know, on a kind of a half-built, you know, spaceship set, you know, that's not even as grand as what you're seeing on screen. So a lot of work is done to create that fantasy that we enter into so willingly as we suspend disbelief along with the actors.
Yeah, that's a really good point, because some years ago, it's not necessarily a genre that I'm all that familiar with or used to, but I went through all those great 50s and 60s epics like Cleopatra with Elizabeth Taylor, simply because it looked so real. Obviously, they weren't using green screens in those days, that they really had all those people on the sets, and it sort of felt like they'd gone to such effort to do what these days can be done on a computer that I really wanted to imbibe that, because, I mean, that comes, you know, that's before I was even born. So I was sort of feeling nostalgic for something that feels authentic. And I guess there's nothing authentic in the sense that obviously what you see on the screen, there's always going to be an element of artifice, and it's a created work. It's not as though somebody has just, you know, put the camera before the actors and said, off you go and create this masterpiece. But I want to believe that dream. I want to sort of watch that and feel they went to such great effort. It doesn't mean to say they can't do that today. I mean, Scorsese couldn't have made Kundun, I suppose, without being able to use green screens, but somehow 50 or 60 years ago, filmmakers were able to do what they were able to do with the technology of their day. And in many cases, it has really endured. And we still see those as really wonderful films, rather than something that has perhaps been replaced by something that, like superhero movies, where you couldn't do them without the technology of the day to make them work.
Well, it's interesting, in Hollywood, even just a few years ago, the sets for the Ten Commandments, I think the silent version of Ten Commandments from the 1920s, the sets that were built out in the desert reappeared. They had been covered over by sands of time, and as the sands shifted, you suddenly had a Hollywood set that was trying to recreate ancient Egypt reemerging at the same time. And so when you were dealing with physical sets and physical places, it does at least have a little bit of that sense of maybe a little more permanence, a little more tactile sense of reality. There's even a new mall that was built in Hollywood that features that they recreated. The walls of it are comparable to D.W. Griffith's Intolerance and his set for ancient Babylon and ancient Greece. So you have these ancient Egypt. So you have these elephants, you know, these massive sculptures of elephants that were created for a movie to recreate an ancient time, now being recreated for a mall for 21st century America in Hollywood. So we've been building and rebuilding and repurposing, sets and images for quite some time.
And how long have you been out there in California, Craig? You mentioned that you were on, did you say at the beginning that you were on the East Coast to begin with?
Yes. So I came out to Hollywood for grad school. I came out about 30 years ago and have raised, a family and had an entire, kind of half a lifetime out here.
What about things like earliest memories when you sort of go back? I mean, it's a great, it sounds like a wonderful, almost like the Western, with the whole sort of the migration from East to West. But I mean, in terms of your case, your own journey, what did you ever imagine that you'd have done before 30 years ago? What do you think your younger self would have imagined that you'd end up doing?
I don't know. My father, sold cars. And so I think I grew up with a little bit of an attachment to cars and racing. I remember the first time I saw the chase scene in Bullet with Steve McQueen, in the Mustang chasing the Dodge Charger, that was kind of a idealized version of, what cars could do, or even Steve McQueen's Le Mans film that in a sense, Ford versus Ferrari kind of traffics in and kind of, recreates a bit. So I think I was because my dad was a car guy, I was kind of into cars and might have imagined that when I was a kid. But I always gravitated towards entertainment. I mean, the television was kind of my constant companion in the house. And so I think the comedies of Norman Lear were really informative to me, which was, in a sense, they were kind of consciousness raising at the time, whether that was All in the Family that was dealing with that generation gap, or with families like Good Times, where you had an African-American family that was struggling but also making it together through love and commitment, to the Jeffersons, who were kind of a successful, financially successful family that still had struggles as an African-American family. So I think I saw these images of America that were both kind of aspirational and realistic at the time. And I think it preconditioned me a bit towards an acceptance of all people, as equals, as created in the image of God. And that was a great gift, I think, that entertainment gave me. Because I suppose maybe I applied that to myself as well. Like, there's no reason why a kid from North Carolina couldn't end up in Hollywood. Why not? Isn't that the kind of thing that happens, in the movies or on TV? So even though I was far removed from it, I guess it also gave me a sense of possibility, a sense of hope.
No, and so in that case, you literally followed that dream, you chased that dream, and it's worked out splendidly. But what about, in terms of the things that you enjoy doing as a child? You mentioned, obviously, you grew up with entertainment. I mean, in my case, music played this. I mean, it's funny, really, because some people associate me with film in the sense that I do work in religion and film. Some people obviously associate me with theology because that's my job title. But music for me was so foundational, growing up with radio in particular, and the charts. I don't know if you had something similar where you were, but it really mattered in terms of those playground conversations. It mattered what was number one in the charts. It mattered what other people were listening to, and it was a good barometer and a good mirror, really, of what we liked. If other people liked the same thing, if our friends in the playground liked or disliked the stuff that we liked, then it kind of gave us some sense of identity and something to play off. But did you have similar experiences?
Oh, I kept rigorous records of Kasem's American Top 40. I literally wrote it out by hand. I'd listen to all, 3 hours and record, who was going up the charts, who was going down. I think the what I loved about pop radio when I was growing up is that you had the variety of voices. It was not that it was, you maybe have a kind of a pop chart that was kind of bubblegum sounds of, I don't know, maybe something like the Partridge Family and David Cassidy, you know, but you could have Marvin Gaye or Aretha Franklin on that same chart. And so you were getting this, again, this mix of maybe suburban and urban of African-American R&B traditions slammed up against pop or even country. You know, somebody like Johnny Cash was on the charts. Glenn Campbell had a weekly television show. And so this eclecticism that is America was presented kind of across the spectrum to say, this is who we are. We're not just one kind of sound, but all these genres, you know, gospel music, soul music, as well as folk music. We brought it all together. And to some degree, maybe that's why somebody maybe like Bob Dylan has remained relevant, because he's channeled that blues tradition as well as that folk tradition. He understands R&B and soul. The songs he heard on the radio, he's still drawing from and reimagining, even on albums that are being released here, you know, in 2020.
No, and I find sometimes I'll be on a journey, a bus journey somewhere, and what a particular song will evoke. I mean, I used to, like you, write down all the charts. I used to record segments, not just of the music, but the DJ's voices before and after, because that is what contextualizes it. And I think the mistake that some people make is to say, oh, well, you know, I mean, if you want a piece of music, well, buy the record, buy the CD, or stream it these days. But having those voices, in terms of giving it the context of who spoke when, the sort of the styles of the time, what we used to wake up to in the morning, who'd be presenting the breakfast show on the radio, those kind of things. Those are the things that strangely ground and matter far more decades on, because that was kind of what made us choose that station rather than another station. It was how we enjoyed a particular broadcaster and their particular talent and the particular ways that they used to keep us entertained and active. And, you know, why would we listen to that program rather than all the many other competitors? And so it's that overall context. And for me, just listening to a piece of music in the car or on a bus, it just takes me back to that. And I sometimes I'm successful in getting hold of those early original programs. I used to record some of them myself, but what a gift to actually have the, you know, and I listen back and I think, yeah, if I was listening to this now, it's as good. It's not just my memory that's distorted in the whole sort of, it was better then than it is now. It really was better then in many respects, and I'm glad to have some concretized version of that. It sounds as though you've had some quite similar experiences.
Oh, very much. And I think that sense of place is so strong. You know, I studied at Cambridge one summer while I was an undergrad, and the sounds of England of that summer are so distinct for me, and who was on the charts. So, I mean, that was Frankie Goes to Hollywood's summer. And so it went from Relax to Two Tribes. And we'd go to a club like the Wag in London. And it was fascinating to hear maybe something by you know, Alison Moyet or Bronski Beats, Small Town Boy, put up against, you know, James Brown's Get Up, I Feel Like Being a Sex Machine. And to see the mashups of American R&B that was being reinterpreted, you know, in London at the time was such a great gift. And it has enabled me to understand, I think, the symbiosis across the pond, right? When you go to Liverpool and you can, you know, visit Paul McCartney's house and John Lennon's house, and you have a sense of them listening to, you know, Little Richard on records that have been brought in, you know, by people on boats, you know, who'd come back from America. How fascinating to see that cultural exchange that can now happen in an instant, right? With the internet, it's all instant. But in that time, it was so much more word of mouth. And you were dependent upon the radio, and you would sit by the radio for hours hoping to hear that one song, you know, on the charts.
Yeah. Well, Woody, you've just taken me back to 1984, because that was when I went to secondary school. And, you know, you're absolutely right. Frankie Goes to Hollywood. And there was something about that period as well, because unlike today, when, as you say, you can just easily stream something, or you can just, you know, listen to what somebody else is listening to wherever. You had to really earn it. It was, you know, there was always a delay, certainly with films. You know, a film release in America and the UK, there were, you know, normally about 3 months. Now that's collapsed into, in some cases, the same date of release. But it felt more important. It felt almost like a pilgrimage sometimes. If you really wanted something, you had to wait for it. You know, the idea of a parent would say, what would you like for Christmas? And you'd say, I want the record of, you know, Alison Moyet, or I want Paul McCartney, or whatever. And you'd wait, and you'd be really patient, and you might get the record after it had first hit the charts, or, you know, but somehow there was something about that physical copy of something. It felt that it was worth the wait. It just feels in some ways quite ephemeral. I mean, for all the joys of being able to press a button and getting what you want, it's like people doing, you know, tracing their heritage. Once upon a time, you would have to go to a place of records. You'd have to go to the local authority or to a library, and you'd have to actually trace all of this, and you'd have to take time out of your schedule to do it. How rewarding it would be when you found out what you needed. These days, you probably just do it by an app. And print it out if you need to, and send it to family members who are not on the internet. You know, that's the extent of it. But it sounds like being in the UK, being in America, what an amazing sort of synergy that must have been.
Well, and we really brought those sounds of the UK back to our campus, you know, at Davidson College in North Carolina. You know, the records we stocked up on records. You know, we got you know, the 12-inch releases of groups like New Order that we couldn't find. They were much harder to find in the States. Those were imports, you know, from factory records, very obscure, you know, they just wouldn't find their way to North Carolina. So we had to bring back the records that we wanted to play on our college radio station or at our campus discotheque. And so it was so fun to introduce those sounds into North Carolina. You know, and try them out and say, will people dance to Two Tribes? Do they like this song? And then maybe people had no idea about the context of the video. They'd never seen kind of the Reagan Gorbachev, you know, interplay of the video, but the sound itself, hey, this is the Trevor Horn production. This was something unique and amazing.
And did you feel that you had achieved that goal in many ways? Was it through you that, you know, some people in North Carolina were then saying, what is this? Never heard this before. Was there a sense? I mean, I get this. You know, I'm an evangelist for films when I want to say to somebody, I remember many years ago, Mr. Holland's Opus, an amazing film. And I was trying to pitch it to a friend who said, I'm not so sure it sounds like. I said, no, you must see it. Eventually he did. And he said, actually, I think I probably at that point flagged it up so much that it was probably impossible to meet the sort of expectations that I'd set up for it. But you know, whether it's music or a film, you want to share that with friends. You want to say to somebody, this has really changed me or transformed me, or it's done something that makes me think differently. And you want someone else to just get an inkling of that in order for them to sort of understand you and your personality and what makes you tick.
Well, and, you know, I was a member of a Gen X. I'm kind of like the world's oldest living Gen Xer at this point. And so in college, we had a certain kind of alternative music that was making its way, that was very much a word of mouth kind of scene. So a band like REM, you know, was from Georgia. They were from a college town. They recorded their first proper LP, Murmur. They recorded that in Charlotte. So they were bringing those sounds up to Davidson College. They played our little college pub twice in 1 year as they were trying out their new sounds that had yet to really be discovered by the world. You know, it'd be another 10 years, right, before people were kind of, what's Losing My Religion, or, you know, where's this little band, REM, this band from Georgia? Well, for us, they were just kind of a local band of, you know, kind of college guys or college dropouts, or we weren't quite sure, but we knew that they were different. We knew that they were an alternative. And so that notion of alternative rock, whether that was coming from England or whether it was coming from, you know, kind of obscure kudzu laced Southern college towns, was in a sense our music that was never quite celebrated as broadly as maybe a Woodstock generation, which got, you know, films and television specials about, oh, the 60s, and wasn't it a time? But our time in the 80s, 90s, that wasn't bad. We liked it all right, you know.
And do you still listen to that same music? And do you listen to it on the same format as you did back then?
I have a lot of my LPs. that my kids actually are the ones who got into. The fact that they were on LP, they're like, oh, look at this, you know. I was also an early rap, you know, I was really into rap as a young guy. So I have some of original, you know, Sugar Hill records of, you know, some of those bands. I have all the early Public Enemy albums, you know, in their original formats. And for me, it's nostalgia. For my kids, it's like, whoa, what is this artifact, you know, from the late 20th century? And I can't believe it still plays on this other ancient technology, you know, known as a record player. So it is kind of fun.
Yeah, I've over recent years started to digitize a lot of the old tapes that I had. It's a lot of work involved, but at the same time, in some cases, as I found out recently with the BBC, I've got copies of things that I recorded when I was 14 or 15 that weren't preserved. I mean, we know that with films, well, certainly with TV programs, you know, Top of the Pops in the UK. There aren't copies of all of their editions. So of course, people like the comedian Bob Monkhouse over in the UK, who used to record all his own programs and, you know, stick it in an attic in the days before people had VCRs, that's been priceless, you know, in later years in terms of having access to those original copies. So it just goes to show sometimes that the fans, the sort of obsessive things that we all do sometimes when we're younger, who would have thought then 30 years later that you might be sitting on a gold mine?
Well, and that it's, you're actually practicing a craft. You know, I recently watched a film called Making Waves. It's the history of sound on film. And Walter Murch, who, you know, really did all kinds of groundbreaking work, whether it was THX-1138 with George Lucas, or The Conversation and The Godfather with Francis Ford Coppola, or Apocalypse Now, which took film, you know, it bigger and wider and broader. It took the soundtrack into new arenas. He did that all as a kid by, just like you, listening to radio programs, kind of splicing things together on his own, tracking the sounds, figuring out how all that stuff is being made and recorded. And so all those hours of practice, right, those thousands of hours devoted as a kid were actually developing him into a craftsman who would go on to win Academy Awards.
Absolutely. And I was just thinking, not too long ago, I watched The Blowout, the John Travolta film, Brian De Palma film from the early 80s. And of course, The Conversation happened to be on TV just as I finished watching Blowout. And of course, you know, it's pretty obvious that the two are related to each other in many ways. But you're right. And it's sort of, it's great, isn't it, to have a film then that's about the craftsmanship, which is exactly what made somebody want to go into that field in the first place, that sort of autobiography. You know, nobody can get away from that. You know, we're all going to be putting a bit of ourselves into the products we make, whether it's academic writing or music or film.
No, that's right. We are part. What's lovely is that the time we were quote unquote wasting as a kid, as it turns out, maybe wasn't wasted after all. Maybe it was actually invested. And we just didn't realize, right, that those tapes would become valuable, that we were doing the work of an archivist, you know, when somebody else who should have been archiving was asleep at the wheel. And didn't realize, you know, that this was history being made at the moment.
No, that's a really good point, because I can remember that I used to record all of these things. And I think, you know, a lot of my friends might have been going out playing sports or doing lots of good creative things. And I'd be editing radio programs of a summer evening. I think my parents used to sometimes just think, you know, OK, but, you know, there are other things that you could be doing. But of course, I look back now and think, well, I'm glad that I followed that through, because it feels at least that whereas some of my friends who may have been a lot cooler than me may not have, kept copies of all of these things. They may have collected other things. They may have collected comics or books or whoever, or whatever it might have been. But in my case, in doing that, I kind of feel slightly vindicated, because I did something that matters maybe more now, or it seems to have a bit more durability than it ever seemed at the time. And it was just something on the radio, you know. It's sort of, you know, why pick that program out of all the many others? But somehow the forces come together, and it's something rather spectacular, and people are dying to have some of those old radio programs, because they just weren't preserved at the time, except of course in our memories.
Well, and memory, I think film and recordings, they are memory making machines. That is how they work on us. That is why they're dream factories. They seep into our subconscious, and obviously you see it in like the films of David Lean and so many others. I don't mind trafficking in nostalgia, as long as I'm not sort of trapped in it. And don't go forward, right? So if I only say, you know, well, Bob Dylan circa, you know, 1976, you know, that's when it ended for me. Right. And if I'm not paying attention, not listening to him now, then I think I'm doing myself a disservice and not following maybe the long arc or trajectory of an artist. So I want to maybe go back to that moment of first love, but then figure out how to carry that love forward. And how do I mature and grow with that love and with that artist? I saw Defy Bloods, the new Spike Lee film, which it uses Marvin Gaye's What's Going On as the soundtrack in beautiful ways. And it's a film that's set in the past, but it's about guys dealing with the pain of the past, the trauma, unresolved trauma of Vietnam. They're dealing with it even now today, right? You know, 50 years later.
Yeah. And it's funny, isn't it? Because sometimes, you know, we want to return to those inverted commas glory days, the music of a particular era. Sometimes there's obviously a bit of a fallow period when we move on, other interests, maybe we grow up a little bit. We, for example, don't get to go to the cinema as often as we used to. In my case, I went through a period of not going to the cinema, and then for various sort of life reasons, and then I started all over again, and I just sort of picked up from where I left off. There's a bit of a middle period for me, particularly over the last decade or so, when I didn't really go that often. But I'd go when I was a university student, and then, in fact, I didn't really start going to the cinema until I was in my late teens, early 20s. And, of course, once I started, I couldn't get that out of my system, and I've really returned to that now with the same kind of, I'm about to say obsession, I suppose there's an element of that, but the same enthusiasm certainly that I had much early on. I think you're right. I think that we all go on a journey. The films travel with us, particularly in terms of format. When you consider that you can watch a film now in pristine Blu-ray or on, you know, you can watch it in a digital format when it looks far superior to anything that we might have seen at the time, either at the cinema or in a more animal, you know, in an analog format on video, for example. But in a way, we're just watching the same product in a better format, and it brings us closer, perhaps, to that original first screening. It's very interesting sometimes how then we don't want to go back to the same technology. We don't want to watch something on videotape again. But we are happy to watch the old film in a new context that continues to give it life, to make it grow, and we grow with it.
Well, and I think, and again, I hope we grow with the artists so that, you know, say with Martin Scorsese, we've been watching his gangsters, you know, Robert De Niro as a young man in Mean Streets with Harvey Keitel to The Irishman. They're still gangsters. But they're no longer young men. And so The Irishman has, I think, a very mature look back at the long trajectory and say, man, that looked kind of cool when we were young. Well, now, when I look back on all those things that I've done on screen, all those murders, there's a soul cost to all of that. And so it can be, in that sense, the nostalgia is a great gift. That we have the gift of perspective, that we're revisiting old characters or old films, but we are now different. And so we're receiving them in different ways. And it's not just who we were when we were 20 or 25, but it's now who we are at 55 or who Scorsese is at, you know, 75 or 85, looking back at those characters and their choices and hopefully learning something from them. I think is it Harvey Keitel who says, like, at the end of The Irishman, right, you're going to be here, you know, like, you're going to be in a wheelchair, you're going to be in the retirement home, and you're going to be needing to go to church and ask for forgiveness. You know, he kind of says it happens for all of us. So there'll be that moment of reckoning, and will you be ready to process your life story through these other stories?
Yeah, and The Irishman was very powerful in that regard because it really had that moment of reflection of somebody who was seduced by the glamour of the mafia, and then, of course, everyone has now died and he's the only one left. And, of course, he's sort of sitting on his own and he has a priest coming to him. And, of course, that very last scene, I mean, you have to sit through 3.5 hours, but, boy, when it comes, what a climax. And it was intensely moving.
Well, and I think that's kind of, that 3.5 hours is part of it. Right? It's sort of like if you're 75, 80 years old, it's like life might have felt like 3.5 hours. It felt long. There was a long lead up to this moment that is actually now the most important moment of your life. All those other moments that were the most important moment at the time have now culminated in yet another choice, yet another moment. And how will you choose today? You know, will you choose life or will you choose death? You know, the shirts that were worn in London in 1984, choose life. I'm still thinking about that. What does that mean to choose life today for Scorsese? And how do we do that?
And just some more, as we're on that theme, some more philosophically based questions around nostalgia, just to start to wrap up, Greg. But would you say that your memories are predominantly positive ones as you survey the whole of your life and career?
It could be that there's overall satisfaction or joy in moments, but I think it's the harder moments that are more formative. You know, it's the hard choices. It's the disappointments. It's the defeats, or the challenges at least, that are what stand out. And I think that's maybe what I love about drama, right? That drama is always about that choice, that kind of two roads diverged in the woods. You know, kind of that. Robert Frost kind of moment, and it's hard to know when you're in it that you're in it, and it really does create a different trajectory for you. And it's only in retrospect when you go back and say, "Ah, boy, that was bigger than I thought, and I don't know if I did the right thing. And now, how do I wrestle with regret?" And come to terms with that.
No, and I think that's a really key answer, because my next question was going to be, is it possible to be nostalgic about negative experiences? And you've exactly hit the nail on the head, because some of the real drivers for us in life can be, you know, those things that didn't quite go the way we wanted them to, and we have to assimilate them or reassimilate them into our lives. And of course, concomitant with that is that whole question of, well, what happens when, you know, New York, you know, on the Scorsese theme is a perfect example of, you know, marrying the dream of, you know, real REAL life with the REEL life. And I think it's that interplay between the two, that kind of, I suppose you could almost call it a form of the in-between, the liminal space, where some of our most creative energies can be channeled. I mean, there's, you know, in terms of your work in screenwriting, you must see that all the time. If everybody was just relaying happy experiences, well, who'd care about that? There has to be some sort of counterpoint.
Well, and also when you maybe ignore those painful experiences, that catches up to you as well. I mean, that's why America is dealing with a reckoning right now. It wasn't that there wasn't ample evidence that there were police abuses. We've had so many cases, from Trayvon Martin to Eric Garner to Philando Castile in Minneapolis. All of those things preceded George Floyd. George Floyd became a bit of the tipping point, right? But we had moments where we could have course corrected, and it may have been less costly, less painful, but we chose to kind of paper over those moments and kind of ignore them and just look the other way, rather than deal with the painful reality of what that death, that unjust death, that police abuse might have meant. And so ignoring the pain, kind of papering over the past, is when you get to the end of the line, you know, like Robert De Niro in The Irishman. And it's kind of like, how did I get here, right? I should be much further along. I should be in a different place. You know, I think Americans have tried to say, like, I thought we dealt with this. You know, what about the Civil Rights Act or the Voting Rights Act? But it's like, no. That Voting Rights Act has to be renewed in a sense for every generation. You know, each generation has to decide what it means and how to deal with our national sin, if you will.
And I think we found it over here, because with Black Lives Matters, you know, we're in lockdown over here, and people have been protesting, saying, well, it's almost like the collision of two different sacred forms. It's like, well, we're you know, to save lives, we have to stay in. But at the same time, there's an injustice. We have to demonstrate our feelings and do something about that. And of course, it's very controversial in terms of people being, you know, protesting in the first place when they're breaching the 2 meter rule over here. And of course, what's happening with various statues being toppled. But people are doing something very authentic, and people are following principles. And that's really interesting, because when we look back on lockdown, I think some, you know, a friend of mine who I interviewed as part of this series a while ago was doing some research on the First World War, and the question came up, you know, did people go to the theatre during the First World War? And the answer was yes, they did. And jokingly, we were talking about this just at the time that Brexit was about to happen in the UK, and we were saying that, will people be saying in 50 years' time, did people go to the cinema during Brexit? Well, yes, they did. But then suddenly we have lockdown, and suddenly we can't go to the cinema, we can't do all the things that we just take for granted, and yet people's passions, people's principles don't just go away because they don't have the outlet, the customary outlet for that to be disseminated. So I think we're at a real turning point, but obviously in America that's very pronounced, and I think we see huge effects of that, and rightly so, over in the UK.
Well, and we're challenged to deal with our past, you know? I mean, that's, you know, I think it's Magnolia. I think Paul Thomas Anderson says, we may be through with the past, but the past isn't through with us. And that's maybe nostalgia's long-term bite, you know, where it's like, we think, oh, that's ancient history, you know? And history is like, excuse me, you know, I've got some unfinished business over here, and I intend to correct it. And so just because you didn't deal with me then doesn't mean you're not going to have to deal with me now. And I think that's maybe the long arms of nostalgia, where we want to distance ourselves, and that history gets kind of jammed up, and that time gets compressed. You know, film does such a great job of compressing time. And I think we're kind of seeing that now, right, where you've got statues being toppled in Bristol, you know, of slave owners that should have been dealt with by prior generations, right? Hundreds of years ago, you could have dealt with it. You didn't, so now we do.
Yeah, and so to be at a turning point, I think you're right. This is a very surprising period, I think, in our history. And I wonder what the filmmakers of tomorrow, well, maybe even the filmmakers of today, but tomorrow will be doing with this. And I'm quite sure that it's going to be a very fertile period for people to be doing, not so much with the superhero narratives that we were referring to earlier, good though they are and important though they are, but also dealing with these issues of social history. In fact, one of the last films I saw before lockdown was based on the Miss World contest in the 1970s, and that whole question of having non-white performers, and how in its day it was seen to be quite revolutionary to have an African or a South African competitor who was black rather than white in that contest. And it seems so fey, it seems so almost laughable from the point of view of today that this would have been an issue. But you know, to make I forget the name of it, but to make a whole film based around that 30 years on, when very different sensibilities are in vogue.
Well, we are each faced with our own moral dilemmas and our own moral choices. And at least I hope, I certainly hope that I rise to the occasion in the right way, so that in a sense my kids don't have to look back at my writings or my work and say, what was Dad thinking, man? That was wrong. That was crazy. That was bad. So I want to try to own as many of those choices as I can now. Correct those mistakes as many as I can now, and maybe hand off to my kids a little less of a mess than it appears that we are handing them.
And actually, my very last question is exactly in that vein. I think you've kind of answered it, really, but are you a looking back or a looking forward kind of person, Craig?
I think all Americans are looking forward types. That's one of our gifts, is perpetual optimism in the face of obvious reasons why we shouldn't be. And so hope springs eternal, whether we have good reasons for it or not. It's a uniquely American amnesia, I think, a limited perspective. Maybe as a young country, you know, it seems odd, right, to say that we're a young country, but of course we are compared to so many other certainly the European context or ancient civilizations, you know, in Asia or Africa. You know, South America. We're young in many ways, and it makes us prone to hope, prone to possibility, which is why I think Hollywood is here, right? I think that's why the Dream Factory is here. We do believe in the possibilities of the future, but it's in it's ignoring the past at our own peril, and so that constant drive of bigger, better. Needs to be counterbalanced by a slower, more thoughtful, and deeper. And so sometimes I think when I go to the movies, I think I'm maybe buying time to try to process what it is that we're going through, where I can't quite figure out my feelings about today. And I need that 2 hours in the dark dealing with someone else's problems to start to deal with my problems. So it's easy to view film as an escape from reality, but I think film at its best is an opportunity to wrestle with very hard truths and frank realities of what's going in our hearts and our minds and in our culture.
That is a perfect answer. I'm going to quote you in my next book. That is terrific. Craig, it has been so terrific. Thank you so much for your time over in California for my latest nostalgia interview. Cheers, Craig.
Thank you, Chris. Keep up the great work. Look forward to more podcasts.